everybody. Welcome to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. We're here to call out stellar work by women in all parts of the film and television industries and share some shows and films we're excited about. We chose this episode's topic, Women Costume Designers, to showcase breathtaking and thoughtful work in costume design. A group of women writers, scholars, producers, and directors talking to you about women deserving heat in Tinseltown.
Ladies, heat it up!
A little bit about us.
Hi, I'm Jennifer. I'm a writer and painter, and my brand is Kick-Ass STEM Women.
Hi, I'm Heather, a writer from San Diego, and my brand is Sexy Monsters Killer Women.
Hey, I'm Marie, the funny feminist screenwriter.
Kiki, a scholar and producer, and advocate for the arts.
Hey, y'all, I'm Carrie. I'm a writer, director, and actress. I write stories about destiny change makers.
For today's episode, with the focus on costume designers, we thought it might help to define the role a bit for everyday listeners. In stage, film, and TV, costume designers make or select the garments and accessories that actors wear based on a close read of the dramatic material and the director or dramaturge's vision for the show. Costume designers can make custom creations for fantasy or sci-fi and or orchestrate the perfect combination of aesthetic scene collaborations by knowing who will be in the scene and what they will wear. This work often involves knowledge of fashion, history, fabric, color theory, and more. I'm so excited about my choice today. I can't wait to dig into this.
Yeah.
I think we'll switch it up today. Carrie, did you want to start us off?
Awesome. Sure. I chose Erin Benoche, costume designer for A Star Is Born, the fourth version of the film starring Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga. Did you love that movie?
Yes, I loved it. And I sang her like, oh, thing like over and over. Now I'm divorced.
Oh, well, that's okay. It had nothing to do with your singing, Marie, I promise.
No,
it wasn't. Erin Benoche had a very interesting transition into costume design. She started out of college as a graphic designer for Penguin Random House Books. Erin described she was very happy in this position, but after several years of 10-hour days in front of her computer, she had an epiphany. She wanted more. Da-da-da-da. Then, as fate would have it, Erin was visiting her then boyfriend, who was a bartender at a trendy New York City bar, where he casually introduced Erin to a patron that happened to be a movie producer. And Erin just piped up, "Hey, I'd love to get into the movie business. Could I intern on one of your films?" The producer said, "Sure, we're filming right now." Erin somehow managed to get the next 2 weeks off as vacation from her Penguin Random House Books job to be on set for the filming of The Baxter, where she was randomly selected to intern in the costume department. She said she was hooked on costume design from there. The film continued shooting after her 2 weeks of so-called vacation, so she would wake up at 5 a.m. to be on set until 8:30 when she had to be at her job at the Penguin Books. Then she got off work early at 4:30 p.m. so she could return to set and stay on set until 10 p.m. and she continued this schedule until filming was done. She looks back at this time in her life as a version of film school, and she said she really learned a lot. Then a mentor took her under her wing, a female costume designer by the name of Jo Newell. Jo Newell was on set of a New York indie film as the costume designer to quickly replace the previously fired costume designer and needed a costume designer assistant quickly, and somehow she found Erin. Jo took Erin under her wing and taught her everything she could about costume design. The experience allowed Erin to launch into indie films shot in the early 2000s in New York City, where she lived, the heyday of the art house indie films. Erin's work continued in the indie space as she started to quickly ascend her craft after working on bigger indie films such as Half Nelson in 2006. Her next big gig was The Lincoln Lawyer in 2011, followed by Drive later also in 2011. Then after several more films in the years to follow, her next big film was A Star Is Born! Da, 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 da. In 2018, Erin received a 2019 Costume Design Guild Award for Excellence in Contemporary Film for A Star Is Born. Erin talks about how she met Lady Gaga to go over ideas for costuming for her character, Allie, Erin said she really wanted Allie's wardrobe to help tell the story of her character's arc from unknown struggling singer in the beginning of the film to where she meets Bradley Cooper's character, Blake Montana, and her wardrobe takes a step up. She had a thrifting vibe, but also hints of country influences from Blake Montana's country music influence. And then onto bigger, better, more elaborate outfits as Allie's character goes on to find newfound stardom and her character arcs in the film and becomes A Star is Born and highlights Allie's plight as her star skyrockets and underscores the film namesake A Star is Born. I have two quick personal stories about costume design and A Star is Born. You ready for this, ladies?
I'm totally ready.
I was a featured extra on A Star is Born when it was filmed in, probably it was 2017. They filmed a couple of places here in the Palm Springs area, but the particular scene I was in was filmed at the Palm Springs Convention Center, and it was just Bradley Cooper. I got to be on set for two 12-hour days back-to-back where Bradley Cooper was 5 feet away from me the whole time. It was super duper awesome.
What did you wear? Did you get to wear your own clothes or did she give you an outfit?
I did not get an outfit, but I was to be dressed up as a pharmaceutical rep. And now, interestingly enough, these 2 days that I was an extra on set, along with like tons of other people, they cut every single solitary scene we shot, except for one, and it's about 3 seconds long. So if you blink during the movie, during the scene, you will completely miss it, which is the back of my head and my hair made it as I'm walking in to this. Yeah, it's the back of my head. The back of my head's famous.
Hey, yay. You have new hair, so yes, I feel like you made a good choice.
Anyhow, it's my hair. They had this whole scene where Bradley Cooper's character was performing at a pharmaceutical convention because his star was fading so bad that was the only gig he could get. The only other really just quick anecdotal thing is I was hip to this movie being filmed before many people were talking about it. So I searched online and I found one still photo of Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga in character. They were at a gas station on Blake Montana's motorcycle. It was a promo picture. And she had on the coolest burgundy boots I've ever seen. And so I took a screenshot of these boots and I researched it and I searched and searched online. Finally, I found these boots and who designed them, what they look like, and what the name of the boot was. And I searched and searched and I found a used pair on eBay in my size. I bought them and I wore them the night that I saw the movie in the movie theater.
No way.
Awesome. Wow. That's
amazing. Yes, full circle moment there, huh, Kiki?
It's in charge of the full circle moments.
Yes, I really love how this costume designer really helps tell the story by how she dresses the character and how costumes really do aid in depicting the character's arc throughout the film.
That's really cool. What was the cowboy boots like? Who made them?
So the funny thing is they weren't very cowboy. They were sort of contemporary and they were Tory Burch burgundy boots with a really thick block kind of wood looking heel. And they were just the neatest color burgundy with this like little braided section. And they were kind of thick on top, but narrow around the foot. They were very unique. So that helped me narrow down on the internet search to find them, which I was very grateful for. But the best part was that I found a slightly used pair for like chump change compared to how much they probably cost.
That's rad.
That's rad. Yeah.
I feel like I have this memory of speaking of costuming of this moment. It's like their turning point where I guess he's accepting an award and he has a body malfunction and she opens her dress in front of him to cover him, to protect him, right? And it's a moment of her, like their relationship shifting so much.
You know, that would be an incredible costuming commenting point, but I don't even remember it. So for you, Marie.
That's cool. I love how not only were you in the film, but you got Lady Gaga's boots and you wore it to the premiere. I mean, that's cool.
Well, the premiere was at the local theater, but I wasn't invited to the big premiere. But to me, it was a premiere.
No, that's super exciting. That's awesome.
Heather, what do you got?
So today I picked costume designer Holly Waddington. Her epic and thoughtful work in Poor Things, starring Emma Stone and directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. So you might be familiar with this costume designer already because some of her other stellar work has been seen in, I believe it's Lady Macbeth and for the series The Great. Love that
Huzzah!
Show. Huzzah! Yeah. We gotta get a little bit more active in the spirit for that. I don't know if you've seen Poor Things or not, but a brief Poor Things movie synopsis would be brought back to life by an unorthodox scientist, a young woman with a brain transplant from a baby must develop from infant to woman while in a woman's body and then runs off with a lusty lawyer on a whirlwind adventure across continents. Film imparts sci-fi and it's part Victorian black comedy, Frankensteinian feminist satire, if you can say that in one gulp, that explores the main character beginning to understand the world and also her continuous sexual liberation due to a missing indoctrination to societal expectations. So it's kind of the experiment is the thing becomes the experiment movie. Mm. That's very, very surreal.
I love that.
Yeah. And it's very much an art flick. So I think that if you're interested in it, you have to be willing to kind of flow with the surreality of it. In terms of costume design, this was huge. I mean, the work that Holly Waddington did to create that surreal flavor of the film is big. And so what I wanted to talk about today is how much I'm loving how and why she made the choices she made in this film, and also the aesthetic and filmic connections between costumes and roles. And I feel like sometimes you watch a movie, the actors, your eye is on their face the whole time. Their costumes are nice, but they're not necessarily doing as much storytelling as the plot. But in this particular film, I picked it because I feel like the costumes are doing equally heavy lifting in a rare and interesting way. Poor Things has been nominated for tons of awards, but it's a rare film where period garments meet a modern aesthetic. In the film, it often felt that the costumes were the visual anchors for both the protagonist's current state and for her lifestyle choices, which is kind of interesting and neat. A black and white stylized part of the film representing Bella Baxter, that's our protagonist, and her second abbreviated childhood. Waddington employs textures upon textures and various modes of partial undress to mimic the way children are never properly dressed. So from bloomers to bustle cages, from puffed sleeve jackets, we see so many unusual choices Waddington has leveraged in this film, which is technically set in 1880s London. I just want to share this quote from her because I thought it was just amazing and it kind of blew me away. So Waddington said, quote, "My favorite piece of costume in the whole film is this weird bustle cage." And then she added, "It's like a piece of art. It looks like a mermaid's tail. It's an underpinning, so something you don't normally see. And they're really intriguing, weird objects. It was made of paper silk and it was really hard to construct. And it was also partly inspired by a Moncler puffer jacket. Basically, I saw this reference in a historical costume book, and I thought, that looks like Moncler. It's really true to the period, too. There's a modernity to the costumes in this film, but everything comes from a historical source. Her bodices, for instance, are based on Victorian patterns. I just haven't been slavish in the use of materials or the way things are worn." So she said that, and then she revealed that the director gave her real freedom in making her own choices, which is another thing I wanted to champion here. I really love when I can pick something and the artist has been able to take their art to the level they want to take it. And in this case, she said the only brief really was that he, and this meaning the director, didn't want it to be overtly like a period drama, and he didn't want it to be overtly like a science fiction film. So cool, right? So I think what's neat about her work in this film is that it is referential, not to what you would expect. These clothes create meaning in this narrative about being a woman Frankenstein of sorts and a marriage of visual meaning and function. She described Bella's costumes by saying, "So in everything you see, there's something missing. She's more dressed up top. She'll have a voluminous blouse on, but with a pair of knickers and bare feet, really childlike fabrics, quilting, ruffles, seersucker, things that felt a bit nappy-ish. There are also lots of references to female genitalia. There's a blouse we call the vagina blouse, then the clitoris blouse.
Wow.
They all have these orifices, a slash down the middle, and then lots of pleats."
Definitely, God. This feels like we need to have a Pinterest page for these outfits.
Yes. Oh my God, I'm so down
right?
for that.
So I'm like, I want some genital tops.
Merch. We need some merch, guys. Genital tops for merch.
Right. And she and the production designer scanned imagery from art, fashion, science. She said they, and this is a quote, looked at seashells, the insides of animals and body parts. Just as Dr. Baxter reassembles humans and other living things, so too did Heath's production design and Waddington's costumes. And then it says, a window evokes a penis and a collar resembles a wing or a ruff.
Okay.
You are watching like anatomy in shapes that you don't expect to see it. Like every moment could be revelatory or referential to something, but not be that thing at all.
It's almost like using that stuff plays with your subconscious.
Yes.
You know, because you're not going to like be seeing it. Now I'm going to definitely look for a window that looks like a penis for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, it's subconscious the first time you see it.
And now you're going to look at who's fingering that vag blouse. I'm nervous. Yeah, but this is really cool too, because for this film, Waddington said anything like lace, beading, or embroidery felt absolutely wrong. So she took her inspiration from Victorian patterns with exaggerated silhouettes, except she also used modern fabrics like plastic and latex. So there's even this condom coat. You want to talk about something being meta? Yeah, in the film, and it looks like a condom, and she's wearing it for her first, for her first sexual encounter in a Paris brothel.
Does she have a hat that's like a condom?
She's literally wearing this coat. Yeah, you have to watch
this. You gotta have the hat.
I have to watch this now.
Yeah, you have to watch it because you have to see the vag blouses and the condom coat. For that alone, you have to see it. And I like how she ended the film with the protagonist wearing a soft textured sweater and kind of long divided skirt that allowed women a decade after the film is set to ride bicycles, which was a nod to women's emancipation.
So much history in clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kudos to Waddington for creating the beauty in the garments in this film, something new and fresh to watch, and also vag blouses and condom coats.
Wow. Yes.
Kiki, can you bring us something delightful to tell us who you picked?
Sure. And I want to admit, this was a little difficult for me because I had to think back to all of my favorite films in which I absolutely adored the costume. I landed on Rear Window. Edith Head did the costuming for Rear Window. It's one of my all-time favorite films. And I love, love, love Grace Kelly's costume. Mm-hmm. And researching who did the costuming on Rear Window led me down a rabbit hole on Wikipedia, come to find out, surprisingly, that Edith Head is the most decorated costume designer in history. She's won a record 8 Academy Awards for Best Costume Design.
Wow.
Right?
8.
She's been nominated for 35 awards and won 8 of them.
Wow. Holy moly.
She's won the most Oscars as a woman in general.
Is she the most decorated? Has she won the most Oscars, men or women, in anything?
In anything, yeah.
Damn.
Right? Yeah. Okay, imagine my surprise. And she began her career as a Spanish teacher, but was interested in design. So in 1924, despite lacking art design or costume design experience, she was hired as a sketch artist at Paramount Pictures. And in my opinion, Edith embodies the edict, fake it till you make it, as she later admitted to borrowing other students' designs for her job interview. And by the 1930s, Edith had established herself as one of Hollywood's leading costume designers and won industry acclaim for her design of Dorothy L'Amour's trademark sarong in the 1936 film, The Jungle Princess. It's really, really historical. Edith gained lots of public attention for the top mink-lined gown she created for Ginger Rogers in 1944's Lady in the Dark, and became a household name after the Academy Award for Best Costume Design was created in 1948. She worked at Paramount Pictures for 43 years until she went to Universal Pictures in 1967, followed Alfred Hitchcock, and that's where she stayed until she died. Over her long career, she has been nominated, like I said, for Best Costume Design a record 35 times and is still the most decorated female Oscar winner. She is known for her unique working style and consulted heavily with the female stars, unlike her male contemporaries. She was a favorite among many of the leading female stars of the 1940s and the 1950s. Ginger Rogers, Betty Davis, Barbara Stanwyck, Jane Wyman, Rita Hayworth, Shirley MacLaine, Grace Kelly, Audrey Hepburn, and Elizabeth Taylor. She was frequently loaned out by Paramount to other studios at the request of the female stars. She has won Academy Awards for Best Costume Design for the following films: The Heiress, All About Eve, Samson and Delilah, A Place in the Sun, Roman Holiday, Sabrina, The Facts of Life, and The Sting. She normally dressed quite plainly, and a fun fact, the visual appearance of Edna Mode, the costume designer in Pixar's The Incredible and The Incredibles 2, was inspired by Head as a tribute to the late designer's work in Hollywood. Aww. Right?
That's because she has the same hairdo.
And yeah, exactly.
My gosh.
So in September 2017, her advice book, How to Dress for Success, and collaboration with Joe Hyam, was optioned by Purple Skies for a film adaptation for her Life and Times. I haven't heard anything else about that yet. I'll have to look into a little more, but I'm definitely excited to see what they might come up with as a film about her life. If you've never seen Rear Window, I suggest you find it on your favorite streaming service and watch it. And a full circle moment for me, Rear Window was the selections today for AFI's Daily Movie Guessing Game. Right? Grace Kelly is the epitome of the perfect girl, and the male lead, James Stewart, literally had to lose it in regards to understand that Kelly's character, Lisa, was indeed the perfect girl for him. And Rear Window is regarded as one of the greatest films of all time, as well as one of cinema's greatest thrills and greatest mysteries. The costuming really brings you into the story, and I'm really looking forward to looking more into films that she's done costuming for and the many people that she's worked with. Yeah, it's a lot.
Thank you, Keith. Absolutely.
This is going to be another awesome curated list. I got to say, every episode so far has made this amazing list of movies. So I'm kind of hoping that when people get hooked on our podcast, they watch a bunch of our lists of movies, because we always bring good ones.
I hope they do.
Right? Yeah.
I love that she was the model for Pixar's The Incredibles, because that is such great character. You know,
it really is. Okay. That's one of my favorite characters in those animated films.
Right? But no capes.
No capes, right?
I do have to tell you, my connection to Rear Window is that my apartment building, if you look out the window, it's the exact same idea. There's a pool area in the center, and then there's walls of apartment building around. And every time I'm up in the morning opening my window, drinking my coffee.
How many characters that you get to see from your window that coincide with the film?
Right, exactly. I'm definitely like the dancer that's dancing, although I'm not as good as that one. But I'm always like,
what's he called? Her Miss Torso?
Miss Torso. I'm like, who's in his pajamas watching me with binoculars right now? Oh my gosh.
That's funny. All right, go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay, so I chose Anne Roth, and specifically her film Working Girl. So, you know, in the movie Barbie, do you remember the old woman that was on the bench? That, and the one that Barbie said, "You are so beautiful." And the woman was like, "I know." That was Anne Roth.
I was wondering if somebody was going to pick her. How wonderful.
And so who's Anne Roth? I'm going to tell you. She is considered one of the most imaginative minds in American culture. And she's been the costume designer for over 109 films. And Nathan Lane called her the Meryl Streep of costume designers. And Meryl Streep called her a novelist designer. Mm. And she's actually best friends with Meryl. Seriously. She has a bedroom in her cottage that Meryl comes and stays with her. And they're planning on a road trip to Italy.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh my God.
And she's done 13 films with Meryl, including Silkwood, Heartburn, Postcards from the Edge, and Mamma Mia, which was like her most fun film that she's ever done. Because she got to go to Italy and drink martinis. And by the way, her martinis, she doesn't drink grain alcohol. She drinks potato.
Ooh.
So just so you know, if she like hangs out at a bar, just don't give her grain alcohol. Give her potato.
That would be such a faux pas. Yeah. Such a faux pas.
There we go.
Yeah. And so what makes her so unique?
I think she had to be the only one who went to Italy to drink potato.
Have potato? What makes her so unique besides being the oldest, which she doesn't like to be called, and she also doesn't like it when you call her amazing.
Oh.
So I'll try not to. But here's what Meryl said about her. Her designs are not so much costumes as an extension of the individual character she is building with an actor and director. So she's all into the details, and sometimes you just don't even see them, but that the actor knows. Ooh. So what she'll do is she'll gather a bunch of stuff and stick it in the closet of the fitting room, and then she'll tell the actor, okay, you and I are going to find this character. But it's not a consultation, because everything that she found is behind this curtain in your fitting room. She's just looked through it. So she'll put things in purses, and sometimes it's a pen or something like a Swiss Army knife. And so Jane Fonda's character, Judy, in 9 to 5, she put in food coupons.
That's perfect.
Right? Because her character was just like, I really need a job. And so that's nothing that you see, but it's like this feeling. Yes. And she dresses everyone, even the bit players. Like she said to one person, like, I'll dress the elevator man. So in Cold Mountain, she didn't just dress Nicole Kidman and Renee Zellweger. She also outfitted the whole Union and Confederate army for their battle. And she took someone and was like, how do you age and dye the fabrics correctly? She went through this whole process just for this battle. And in The Hours, where Nicole Kidman plays Virginia Woolf, she convinced her to wear a big latex nose to play her because her nose was too perky. Mm. And she had a nose maker from England to make the right one. It totally pissed off Harvey Weinstein because he was just like, I paid $1 million for Nicole Kidman and no one's going to see that. So she posted security guards on every entrance so that his henchmen wouldn't try to interfere.
Whoa.
That's good for her.
Yeah. And Nicole won the Oscar for that. Right. And so in Places in the Heart, Sally Field, she made her wear an authentic crotchless girdle. And Sally was like, what? And she's like, dude, you're going to sit and walk differently. And again, Sally won the Oscar for that role.
Yeah.
So it's this feeling that it doesn't matter if you don't see it. It's just like, how do you create the authenticity of character?
Oh, neat. I love how she's just creating the mood and almost giving them backstory with these props and a depth that they can play off of for their characterization. That is so cool.
Right. It's so authentic. And she made the bottom in Ma Rainey's black bottom for Viola Davis to make it look like Aretha Franklin's, because Viola Davis asked for that. So she also put stuff under her boobs to make it look big. So she wanted her to have a big bottom. And then that time, Anne won the Oscar for Ma Rainey's black bottom. Her other Oscar is for The English Patient.
Oh, I love that movie, The English Patient.
I know.
Wow. It's very so different. She's very, has a big, vast range.
Right? Yeah. That's such a beautiful movie. So she doesn't go for the beautiful, fancy costumes as much as the real, the authentic. That's what makes all the looks so iconic. In The Owl and the Pussycat, she made Barbara Streisand that nightie with the satin applique cups, cupping her breasts with a heart on her coochie. I saw that film. I don't really remember what happened in the film, but I totally remember that nightie. I'm just like, oh my God. And she said Barbara was so not into it, but if you can't say no to anyone. Barbara's like, what? She's like, just do it. Like, she'll just make you do stuff. One time someone said, I don't like yellow. And she's like, shut up. She works closely with the director. And as Meryl pointed out, it's about her and the director and then the actor. And her favorite by far was Mike Nichols. She had a working relationship with him for over 50 years and plays like The Odd Couple and then 13 films, including Working Girl. And Working Girl, oh, I love this film.
I do too. Oh my God, it was such an 80s. Oh, I love this film.
And there's so many parts of it. But what I love about it in terms of how she does the costuming. So Melanie Griffith plays Tess McGill, and she's like Long Island, this accent. She has super huge, big hair, really flamboyant makeup and really tight skirts and just looks kind of trashy and stuff. And she wants to get into business and people just don't take her seriously. She finally gets a break when she works for Catherine, who's played by Sigourney Weaver. And she's all smooth and just impeccably dressed in like modern classics and just like sort of breezes in. And so she's sitting there with Tess and she shades her with this Coco Chanel quote, dress shabbily and then remember the dress, dress impeccably and then remember the woman.
Ooh.
Tess is all like, how do you look? And she's like looking away and she's like, oh, you look fine. You might want to rethink the jewelry. And so instantly she goes into the bathroom and she takes off a bunch of bracelets that make noises and she takes some of those off. So already her transformation starts and it just keeps going further. And at the same time, you have this juxtaposition with her best friend, Cynthia, who's played by Joan Cusack, who's even more 80s tacky.
A lot of big
her eye makeup.
It's a lot just, of blue eye makeup and shoulder pads, I remember.
Yes, and just the hair. And of course, she doesn't want to change. She's really comfortable in who she is. She's able to just show this juxtaposition by Joan Cusack's character. Supposedly, we see it as tacky, but you know that she thinks that she looks really good. So what happens is that Catherine goes away on a trip and she's able to go into her apartment and look through her stuff. And at one point, point, because in the plot of it, she has this idea and actually Catherine, her boss, is going to steal it from her. And she finds that out because she's going through her messages on this recorder thing. And so she's just like, fuck that, man. And she takes some of the invitations she has to business, like this business meeting thing that's at this bar. And so she doesn't really know how this thing plays out. So she just takes one of Catherine's dresses. It still has a tag on it. And like Joan, you know, her best friend Joan's looking at it and she's all, $6,000? And it's not even leather. So then Melanie Griffith's Tess McGill, she takes some muscle relaxers, which doesn't really work out very well at the end of the night. But she goes with this beautiful dress and everyone else is like total business. And she's got a cocktail dress on. What I love is the transformation. It's like the dress to success transformation. It's so real and organic. And by the time that she's more like herself, she's not putting on anyone else's clothes. You can feel that she's comfortable in it. Like she's figured out her own classic style that also conjoins with her realization of her own power and brain power and how she's able to know that she can do this job. I love how she pairs the costuming with the emotional arc that Tess goes through and how she's able to win at the end. I just want to say some other endearing facts about Anne Roth. She's worn the same blue polish since 1953. The women were like, oh my God, you're wearing blue, you know, toenail polish. Like it was really a big deal. And she's just like, deal with it.
Like, is it like Chanel? I mean, how does that color not go out of?
How is she still getting the same nail polish?
Yeah.
They make it just for her.
You know what? That's a deep dive I haven't done.
She just buys different brands when one of them goes out of making the color, but it's exactly.
It's the same color, and she would know color. Mm-hmm. She knows
that's true.
And she's got over 2,000 drawings of her costumes with fabric swatches. And she has a warehouse that's just a few miles away from her house, and it's filled, totally filled with costumes of every decade.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wonder if she has actresses over and she's like, do you want to visit my warehouse?
Oh, I would have to dress up at her house. Like, can I go play dress up at Anne?
That would be fun.
Slumber party.
I would always be like, so let's go to the warehouse.
Say you have now inspired me and unfortunately caused me to peer over very many photos of Virginia Woolf's nose. Thank you very much.
Oh, good. I mean, Virginia Woolf kind of has that long face and with the nose, and she was just like, I can't deal with your nose, Nicole.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also that Virginia Woolf is such a cult figure in literature that the audience for this film, lit fans, right? Literary aficionados, and they all know what Virginia Woolf looks like.
Yeah.
So she was protecting Nicole Kidman in a certain respect as well. For that reason.
She just said that her nose didn't go with the era.
You were born at the wrong time.
Yes. It's just like, I don't think so. But she also was a costume designer for Clute. And there's this amazing, fabulous sequin cocktail dress that Jane Fonda wore. And so for about a year, they would exchange it. Like Anne would wear it and Jane was like 4 inches taller and she'd just pin it up and then go to a cocktail party and then she'd send it back to Jane. Jane would wear it. She'd send it back to Anne. I don't know who ended up with it. Probably Anne since she has the warehouse. But she's 91, dude. She's 91 and she's still working.
That's amazing. So
she's badass and brilliant.
Absolutely.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Get me some of that nail polish so I can live to be 91.
It has to be blue, Marie. Blue.
That's her secret.
Blue is my favorite color, so maybe I'm on my way.
So, Marie, we haven't heard your choice yet. Let's hear what you pick.
I'm so excited because I really went into this knowing nothing about costume design, and I'm just so grateful to have had this opportunity, and especially when the worlds came together, that Jenny Beavan is such a major costume designer, and she did Mad Max Fury Road, which I just was like, this movie has to make it into the podcast at some point. So magic was happening. And Jenny Beavan is just also this like dope person. She is amazing. She's won 3 Academy Awards and 4 BAFTA Awards, which is the British Academy Film Award, and 2 Emmys. The ones that she won for, the 3 times, were Room with a View in 1985 for Cruella and then Mad Max Fury Road. And she's been nominated 12 times. She started on the stage. She did work for the Royal Theater, the Royal Shakespeare Company, the West End Theater, and of course on Broadway. And then when she started in film, she started a relationship with Merchant Ivory Productions, and they've been paired together and worked together many, many times throughout her career. The movies she's made, the list is so, so long, so I can't even begin to list them all. She generally has worked on historical films. So she did A Room with a View, White Fang, Howard's End, Swing Kids, Remains of the Day, Sense and Sensibility, Jane Eyre, the 1996 version, Ever After, Emma, Black Dahlia, The King's Speech, and just so, so, so many more.
I just watched Ever After the other day. That's amazing.
Yes!
Full circle.
So this is funny. I feel like we almost have a theme that some costume designers are not that much fashionistas, and she's for sure not. She declares it, and she's pretty open about that. And she has made some pretty cool choices. So for one Academy Award, when she was accepting the award, then I don't know if you guys remember this. I didn't know this was a thing, but at the Mad Max, when she won the Mad Max, there was a big kerfuffle around this. So she's walking down the aisle and everyone's clapping, but right along the row on either side is just like this row of men, and none of the men are clapping.
I remember that.
Controversy. Why was this?
I remember that. It was kind of shocking.
It was shocking.
That's lame. What jerky men.
Yeah. So like we cannot ever read people's minds, nor I'm sure would they ever like admit what they were thinking. Was it because she was not the cookie cutter, beautiful, giant dress, like gorgeous look when she was walking down the aisle? Because she was herself. She has this like amazing head of this curly gray hair and is just this kick-ass lady. She's wearing this pants and a black motorcycle jacket that she's got bedazzled on the back with a skull on the back from the movie. And it's just this amazing outfit. Yeah. So maybe she was pushing some boundaries. And I love that when she was interviewed about it, just had this great attitude about it. She just didn't care what they thought. And loved one thing she said about it, which was, the only thing I would like is for my outfit to have an effect on how women feel about themselves.
You
don't actually have to look like a supermodel to be successful.
Oh, that's amazing.
I remember her outfit and I was just like, whoa, look at that jacket. Because it felt like her jacket was loved.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, I felt like she's wearing what she really loves, and she probably made it since she's a costume designer. She looked comfortable and confident.
She was, yes. And I remember her saying something about how she didn't want to trip, so she wore really practical shoes.
Good.
Smart.
She has a really cool process. And this was, again, so wonderful for me to get a picture on what costume designing really means, which is that it really is telling a story. It's using costuming to support the story by showing character change. So what she does first is she takes a script and she studies it really carefully, and she really gets to know each character and how the character grows and the story for each character. And then she thinks about how the costumes are going to be part of telling the story of each of those characters. And then she rents a lot of the costumes. And that's something that people who are not insiders in Hollywood know, is that there's a lot of rental of costumes. So there's a whole industry of costumes being made available. And that means from indie to big productions, people can get access to costumes. So she does rent some. These can be massive productions. And so she ends up making a lot of them, right? Mm-hmm. Emma Stone wore 47 costumes for Cruella.
47.
Those costumes in Cruella were phenomenal.
Yes.
Absolutely.
They were art, right? They were like these big art pieces that were created as art.
Yeah.
And then you need to think about the scale of the work. These are massive casts. So she does mostly historical pictures. So you've got these major casts, right? Giant casts. And there are people that are wearing things with a million little buttons and bows and strings and shoelaces to tie. And people need to get them in and out of these costumes. So it's just this amount of work. They need to maintain the costumes, keep them clean, have duplicates of all of them, just stay organized about it. And she also talks about how good costuming, it's there and ever present, but when it's good, it also hides itself, right? So it's like supporting the character and supporting the story. So she says, in general, costume designing done well is invisible and never intrusive.
Because you see the character and not the costume.
Yeah.
Right?
So I've been thinking a lot about that. It's really just the supporting the character. I don't know if you've ever heard this about the saying that a writer is responsible for the story, a director the tone, and the actor the characters. But I feel like the costume designers are also carrying the characters and the story and the tone. They're sort of in everything. So another really, really, really cool thing is that if you watch Mad Max, we see the clothing before we see the characters. We see their bodies, and some of them are, of the major characters, are shot from behind. So we're seeing their outfits before their face. It's deeply in the introduction of who the characters are. And I'm just excited that Charlize created such an amazing character and the costume was so good for it, to create this whole world in a really different kind of action movie. To see it break some tropes of the genre. This is not a boy saving a girl damsel in distress, right? The women characters are dynamic and strong, and they are action heroes that are saving themselves and saving the day. In action movies, it's either the woman being saved or the woman is sort of like, she is the hero, but she's the sexy sidekick. In this dynamic, Furiosa, the leader of this story, she takes over this mission and turns it into her own mission, which she's trying to get the wives of the leader to help them escape, because they're not wives by choice. They're basically enslaved to him to give him children. And so it really becomes a story about these women escaping, and the wives, they go from like soft and they've been tucked away and hidden, and they become strong and help protect themselves as they're being pursued. And Furiosa just is this strong woman. In fact, she's leading the show, and it's Max that joins her cause, and he totally contributes. And they, one of the war boys, he gains purpose. They're indoctrinated into this belief system where they're just looking for glory, and he actually gets to do something that's of value. I loved how in the movie Max respects Furiosa so much. There's just this super powerful moment where there's this shotgun and there's three shots available, like three bullets. He shoots one. He misses like the bad guy that's like coming impending on him. He shoots the second one and she's right next to him. And then he hands her the gun and she leans on his shoulder and she takes the shot and gets it. And it's just like so much respect. And the costume all supports this. It all supports the characters in the journey. So she had a really cool design process because they shot this in the desert for several months. They didn't just have the hardship mythologically in the movie. They really were in this rough environment with all the sand blowing around. A lot of the action shots were done in real life, so the costuming had to be sturdy enough to withstand that and safe enough. So she had some really big challenges, and she had to make so many things to make this work. What she tried to do as she was conceptualizing this is, we're in a dystopian future, right, where there's such a massive limit of resources. So she was like, how do I design things with materials that they actually would have had? And so that's just a really cool challenge that I think adds a realness to it. So cool kind of thing that she had as a challenge for her is that there's tropes for what different dystopian futures look like. And there's a certain one look that's sort of like punk look. It was really big in the 70s and 80s, but at some point it became cliche. So she was tasked with creating something that fit in the Mad Max world, but wasn't quite the same. That had some homages to the original. For example, Max... everyone thinks of Mad Max and his moto jacket, but this time it's ratty and the stitching's a little looser. Spends a lot of this film in a mask because he's muzzled. And he's wearing a mask a lot of the time. So it's just such a cool thing to see. A movie where one of the main characters, you don't actually see the full face for a while. And there's the wives that are escaping, and they've got these little gauzy white wrapping outfits that are like scantily clad. And my first impression when seeing it, this was the first time I saw it, I was like, okay, right, so these scantily clad women, I don't love seeing this. But then when you now think about it, it's like she was showing that these women were unprepared for the environment. They were kept in an unprepared state. And so they were going to be on this journey of total growth for how to survive in the tough world. And then they had the many mothers, and that's just these tribe of women who I just loved seeing. Older women, these powerful women, but like they were both powerful and gentle and strong and caring. And their costume was so great because it was just so practical about survival. And supposedly some of the outfits were meant to have been convertible to a tent because they were living a nomadic life. Those were my favorites. And then we got to talk about Furiosa. Her costume was so cool. It's just all about function and power. She's got these leather belts and this really super functional clothing. But yet she has this shirt that's very practical, but you can see that it looks like the gauze that's reminiscent of the wives, but it's stained. So it gives a hint of what was she, was her role before that, before her warrior role now. But she just kicks ass no matter what. She's just strong. It's not even a question. She's just totally strong and capable. And just so impressed by what Jenny Beatman has been able to do, and just also just who she is as a woman. Like, she's just pulled all this stuff off. And I just love that this costuming had to face the real challenges of desert life. And she had to think not just of look of it, but that they had to do stunts in these. So they needed to be able to be clipped onto things, and they needed to be safe. Like, safety is a really big thing on sets nowadays, thankfully. So everything needs to be able to be worn, but still be safe for these fight scenes and hiding the harnesses and things like that. She's just knocked my socks off, and I feel like so excited to have learned about her process.
Wow. That's so cool. And also to think about like how long actors would be filming is such an interesting thing. What the costumes need to withstand. Mm-hmm. You were talking about sounds fascinating for this film in particular. Wow, a great list. Okay, so we will post this list on launch day at the Hot Redhead Media blog, so you can go check out all these awesome films and clap back if you have more to say on them.
Well, wait, we still got the snack segment. Who's doing it?
That would be me. I like my snacks low maintenance. I'm offering today air fried buffalo chicken wings with celery sticks. And that's the I like for a movie night watch. And here are the tips for how to do this in the most painless way possible, because this is a super easy snack to make even while you're actually watching the movie. I can do this snack mid-process. And the first step is you'd preheat an air fryer and get out the wings you're going to cook. I like to make 2 packages of 2 pounds each, and I have Ninja Foodies, so I gun them both up at once. Not everyone will do this, but I like to do it that way, but you can make one in one. And then step two is you put your wings into the air fryer. And then my setting for air frying is for 30 minutes. And I just flip them half the way through. I don't even put anything on the wings. Literally, this is the laziest, easiest, most delicious snack to make. You just throw them right into your air fryer pan after it preheats, cook for 15 minute flip, cook another 15 minutes, take them out, and then season them. And an added bonus about this snack is that you can, like I said, start your film and watch it as you're preparing the rest of what you need while the wings are air frying. The step that I just do to make it easy is I will get out, wash, and cut up my celery to have it ready. And then I will take my favorite kind of buffalo sauce, put about a cup or so into a bowl, and I will microwave it. This is the secret, guys, to making your buffalo sauce really luxurious and delicious on your chicken wings. I will microwave it with 1 to 2 pats of 2 tablespoons real butter. And then I will mix it through. Yeah, that's the business right there.
Okay.
So, and then just as soon as your air fried chicken wings come out, you brush them with the sauce, plate your celery sticks with the wings, get out whatever celery dressing you like. Ranch or blue cheese is a house favorite at my house, and eat. Then all you need, if you want to be a barbarian, you don't even need utensils. See, this is the plan. It's the extreme ease of my snack. You just need a napkin because it is very messy, and that's it.
Or you can be a heathen and just lick your fingers.
Yeah, you could, but they might still have a little slime.
Yeah, I don't know.
I would go for the napkin in this case. Go ahead and let yourself have that. This isn't necessarily very healthy, but 2 things in its favor. At least it was air fried. Okay, so you skipped out on extra grease and oil, and there's fiber in the celery.
And it's win-win.
And it's super delicious. So that's the snack I'm offering for movie
night. I'm here to tell you, although celery is healthy and high in fiber and so low calorie, there's some data to suggest that it takes more calories to digest celery than there are actually in celery that you would net gain.
Food.
Yeah. Hey. As like you mentioned, Heather, it offers a low calorie, heart healthy option to frying. You either use no oil or much less oil or butter if you air fry. You could even leave the butter out of the buffalo sauce.
Oh, no, you can't.
Oh, no. Carrie!
That's Carrie.
Oh, okay, Carrie. Okay. It's Fem Blast trivia time.
All right. You all ready for trivia?
Yeah, Kiki.
Yeah, go for it, Kiki.
All right. So on the last episode, we gave the trivia question. The first woman to direct a film also wrote, produced, and created costume designs for her films. Who was she? Hint, the film was narrative fiction, an 18 short called The Cabbage Fairy. Answer it, Alice Guy Blanchet. And while Blanchet's accomplishment isn't talked about as much as it should be, it is undoubtedly a notable one in women's history.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh,
fantastic. Yeah. So I wanted to stick with the theme of having our trivia question this month lead into next month. So next month, we are discussing women in comedic roles. So pencils up, heat seekers, who was the first woman to have a self-produced comedy special on a cable television network?
That's a good question.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Have a self-produced comedy special on a cable television network.
Yes.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I hope somebody calls it out on our social media when we post the question.
Yes, we'll see.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood. To check out our newest curated watch lists and episodes snacks anytime, please visit www.hotredheadmedia.com for our blog posts. And if you like books as well, please sample Hot Redhead Media's bookish sister podcast, Book Tales, where HRM pairs custom cocktails with newly released books and readings and craft talks with authors. But if you love your focus on women creators in film and TV, subscribe to Heat, Spotlight on Women by Women in Hollywood for more episodes on women reshaping the narrative in Hollywood. Episodes release once a month. Till next time, stay awesome.